irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to State of the Arts with Michael Sterling and Paul Strolley right here on LA Talk Radio.
Yes, you are, and I am not Paul Strolley today.
You are not, but you are an amazing. You're a reasonable facsimile, yeah. I would say. You're pretty close.
I'm not as good looking as you, though.
You're far more dashing, Michael.
You think?
Know that. You're in this relationship. You are very much the elegant one, and I'm the bratty brother. Obnoxious, smartass. However you want.
I don't know if I would agree with all that, but thank you for the compliment. I appreciate it. Yes, I am Michael Sterling today.
Yes, you are. Yes,
I'm so excited to be here.
Yes, no, we have more talent in this room than we've had in a long time, and that's without you and me in it.
Exactly.
I know.
And I'm thrilled to be meeting. I've met these gentlemen before earlier this week, which was the first time, which was amazing. And now to have them here a whole hour with us.
Whole hour. Fantastic. We've been having such a great conversation beforehand.
Which
we don't normally get an opportunity to do.
I understand. So should we thank our sponsors first?
Why don't you, Michael? Let's do that. Let's pay the people who pay the bills.
Absolutely. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Breakdown Services, the entertainment industry standard used around the world, providing the most professional means to reach talent agents as well as actors when casting a project. To learn more about Breakdown Services, visit BreakdownExpress.com.
We'd also like to acknowledge PerformingArtsLive.com, one of the Internet's most prominent listing sources for the live arts in Southern California. We're grateful to Performing Arts Live for lending their support to our live arts calendar.
Indeed.
I also spoke to Mike Napoli today of Performing Arts Live. I was telling him about the thing that I was doing, or that I am doing out at Will Geer Theatricum Botanicum, and he praised it as one of the nicest outdoor theaters that we have in Southern California.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah.
Good.
Nice guy, Mike.
Yes, he is.
And he's a paisan, so what are you going to do?
He's a
good guy. Yeah.
You know, the world premiere, Paul, of Waterfall marks a groundbreaking collaboration between American and Asian theatrical artists. The musical, based on a contemporary classic, a Thai novel, Behind the Painting, by Cerebo Rafa.
Very well done.
Didn't you know?
You did that without a net. She's not here. We didn't even invite her, but that's not the point.
Okay. Good. Bada bing. Okay. Features book and lyrics by Tony Award winner Richard Maltby Jr., Ain't Misbehavin', Miss Saigon, and music by Oscar winner and two-time Tony Award nominee David Shire. Baby Big, one of my favorites, really, in collaboration with Richard Maltby Jr.
The production is directed by Broadway and Thai theatrical impresario Tak Viravan and co-directed and choreographed by Tony Award nominee Dan Konectis. We are lucky enough to have the two creators of Waterfall with us today right here in studio. Please welcome Richard Maltby Jr. and David Shire.
Welcome, gentlemen.
Hello, Michael. Hello, Paul.
A pleasure.
Great to be here.
Pleasure to have both of you here.
Absolutely. We're sorry that the sun did not come out to greet you today.
However. Well, we can only cover so much.
California. It's cold and it's damp.
You
right?
know.
Like that's a Randy Newman reference right there.
It's about a drought.
A Larry Hart reference. Lady is a Tramp.
Yes.
See, in the beginning of I Love L.A., Randy Newman says, I hate New York City, it's cold and it's damp, and all the people dress like monkeys. So I didn't know he borrowed
it. He was borrowing it from Larry Hart.
He was,
Little hooligan.
See?
Yeah. Huh?
I had no idea.
All right. Before we talk to Richard and David, let me ask you, how was your week?
My week was fine, Michael. You know, do I look frail to you?
Not at all.
Do I look frail?
No.
Okay. Because I think I may look frail to some people, specifically the people who work at Vons.
Oh.
Because I went into Vons yesterday, I bought two avocados. That's all I bought.
Yeah.
Two avocados.
Right.
Woman who checked me out says, do you need help out with that? I said, there's two avocados. Do I look like I need help carrying two avocados to my car?
But
I think there's an avocado conspiracy, actually.
Really?
I have this thing about avocados. I want to know why someone decided that avocado was the one vegetable that you charge for. Because think about it. You go to Subway, you go to these restaurants, you want to put avocado on that? It's extra. It's 50 cents. It's a dollar extra for an avocado.
Well, it's more expensive.
But you could put 12 pounds of tomatoes on a Subway sandwich. They won't charge you a dime.
Right.
But yet the avocado, what do you think?
Who decided
that avocado was green gold? That's what I want to know.
Well, I think they're probably a little less inaccessible as vegetables. They're not grown all over the country.
It right? Could be.
And maybe it's the transportation costs of getting them here?
Either that or...
And the water they use.
Either that or I just have too much free time and I'd be even thinking
about
this.
You know, it takes 40 gallons or something of water to make one almond.
Does it really?
And 450 gallons of water to make one hamburger patty.
Holy cow.
Well, you see, there you go.
You
have an answer.
I'm president of my homeowners association at my condominium, and we are getting $3.50 a square foot from the city to pull up our turf and replace it with drought-resistant plantings. Wow. $3.50 a square foot. So we're going to do sort of a desert landscape with stone and stuff and try to save some water and save our state, as it were.
Yeah. Yeah. Important.
How was your week?
It was good, actually, and I got to meet our guests, as I mentioned earlier, at the beginning of the week on Tuesday. There was a beautiful press day to take a little bit of a preview of Waterfall, a couple numbers that they were kind enough to do for the press.
Oh, really?
And we were there and interviewing these gentlemen and the stars of the show. And I must say, as I said to our guests today, that they've written something that I think has all the makings of a classic.
We were speaking on the phone about it before this, and you had said that it's exciting to be involved and even discussing something at this stage when you can see so many rich possibilities.
Exactly. This week, of course, in particular, with your show opening and so many others in town are opening, Matilda is at the Amundsen as well, opens on Sunday, as well as your show. And, of course, the Tony Awards on Sunday.
Yeah.
How exciting. Always exciting. And I'm looking forward to seeing that. And it must be something that's very routine to you, gentlemen.
Oh,
right?
Sure. Yeah, right. We're really jaded about the Tony Awards. Invite us to the Tony Awards because we got nominated. Oh, dear. Not again.
Not again. Oh, it's like Streep, you know. Why does she go anywhere?
That's why we have to open at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. We call it opening night,
right?
But it's really opening afternoon.
Oh, so everyone can make it to the home in time.
In fact, there'll be television sets at the party so that it can bleed right.
Oh,
into
sure.
The
our opening night party is a Tony party. It's not even for us.
Well, it will be. It will be eventually.
Hopefully.
It will be. Yeah.
And I will be at the Actors Fund covering that and their big fundraising event for the Tonys.
You have such an exciting life.
Well, I'd actually,
why don't I have your life? I'm obsessed with avocados. That's why I don't have, because I am mired in this minutia. That's what
Excuse
it is.
Excuse me. Well, we'll take care of that, Paul. Easy.
Well, wonderful. Well, that sounds exciting.
Yep.
Michael, would you introduce the gentleman to your
left? I'm so happy to do this. Our first guest, ladies and gentlemen, conceived and directed the only two musical reviews to ever win the Tony Awards for Best Musical. A Misbehavin' in 1978, which also won the Tony, New York Drama Critics, Outer Critics, and Drama Desk Awards, as well as the Tony Award for Best Director, and Fosse, which won the Tony Outer Critics and Drama Desk Awards. He was director co-lyricist for the American version of Andrew Lloyd Webber's Song and Dance, starring Bernadette Peters, as well as being co-lyricist for Miss Saigon. But that's just a sampling of this man's resume, and today we're discussing his latest work, Waterfall, a world premiere being presented by Pasadena Playhouse. Please welcome Richard Maltby Jr.
Hello
again. How are you?
I am very well.
Yes?
Yeah, we've just had our, sixth preview performance?
Yeah.
Really, we've been really making use of the previews. Every show we add, we fix, and the show just, gets better and better. Previews are kind of like, they're like Nielsen's. You change five things and the audience response goes up this much. Mm-hmm. You change five more things and the audience response goes up that much more. You know, 10 more people stand up at the end. You know, you get an immediate reaction to the work you've done during the day.
How long a process has it been, Richard, from the first you and David
getting
together?
Because, of course, you can't remember when you started. There's right. the moment that you first had a conversation about the show.
Right.
And then there's the first moment you actually put pencil to paper
yeah,
which
yeah.
is sometimes a year or a year and a half after that.
Sure.
And then there's the process of writing it and then you start readings and it keeps developing. I think probably from the first conversation on. It's been 4 years, which is relatively fast.
Yeah, no, I was expecting it to be more, especially with something. I'm seeing the word epic quite a bit in this, so I'm assuming this is a fairly grand undertaking, this piece.
Well, I can tell you, I can promise the audiences that this is a grand production. Okay. I mean, it is probably the most spectacular production that physical production that Pasadena Playhouse has ever done.
It's, oh, wow. And that's saying something.
Scenery, yeah. and dancers, costumes. It's every set. It looks like a Japanese painting. It's really stunning. Yeah. A large orchestra. The set crew is kind of
and the costumes
amazing.
Too. The
costumes
are
amazing. It's an eyeful, and that's not even counting actors or the story.
Sure, sure. And actually, thank you for segueing that for me, because I wanted to ask you, can you, without giving away too much and to just tease people so they'll come see it, can you give a sort of a little thumbnail synopsis of the narrative?
Well, it's a love story. It's a genuine love story, and I think actually quite unique. It's a generational love story. A 22-year-old Thai student falls in love with the American wife of a Thai ambassador. She's 35. The ambassador is 65, and each of the love relationships in this story are unusual. I think when all is said and done, people are quite surprised by it. There's one line in the show that says there are many kinds of love, and the show represents quite a lot of that, which is nice because then we get to write different kinds of love songs and other things. It's also because it's an American woman in Asia, it brings into bear the whole issue of American influence in Asia in the 30s, which right. people don't really understand. Really, Americans don't know much about this period.
Right.
But at the beginning of the 30s, American culture was sweeping Asia. Popular
really?
Music, movies, it was going like wildfire. Part of the reason why it was resisted so much by the establishment was that it was so popular. When the group came in that eventually led to Pearl Harbor and everything, the first thing they did was ban American music.
Really?
Music, because music is the most dangerous
because
revolutionary
music,
thing in the world.
Because music is independent thought.
It's independent thought, yeah. And you can't do anything about it.
Right.
Plato said it. Plato said that music, you know, don't trust the kids with music. And he knew.
Yeah, he knew. Oh, that's fascinating. That's fascinating. So in terms of your process, and once again, like I said, this is we're really more of a roundtable discussion here, even though we'll focus on one of you for the first and the other for the second half. But I'm always curious about the process of composing and assembling something together. I know, like, I'm a big Elton John fan, and I know how Elton John worked with Bernie Taupin, and that was basically Bernie Taupin would just hand a lyric sheet to Elton John, and Elton John would do what he would with it. What is your process like together? You have known one another so long. You've worked on different projects together. Is it always the same process of creation?
It's the same process.
Yeah.
The specifics always change, but the same process, which is, if it's for a show, it's what's going on in the scene, who the characters are, what's happening to the character, how does a part of the scene shape itself into an emotion that's a song. If it were a song, where would it start and where would it end? Because in the theater, songs have to go someplace. They're actions as well as emotions.
Right.
And then it sort of, you know, coalesces around an idea, maybe a title, maybe a structure. Maybe we'll start here and go there. We kind of get a sense of that. Sometimes I write some words to it. Sometimes I write a complete lyric, but not terribly often. What usually happens is that when we start having an idea that's good, David runs off with it, and I love that because his music is quirkier and more idiosyncratic than anything I would come up with
Okay.
Left to my own devices, I'd write doggerel. But if the music is going then I can write something that's actually much quirkier and more alive.
Do you find that your friendship, because I mentioned earlier the whole idea of you two being sort of the musical equivalent of Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner, and which you took as a compliment, which was
made me happy.
Yeah. I'm curious about the friendship and the work relationship, because sometimes I work with friends of mine too, and I'm cautious about being honest, creatively honest with people in sort of saving their feelings or things like that. Is that something that you've ever encountered? Or?
You know, somebody asked me, you know, how we could possibly have been working together as long as we have, because we met in college, and how we survived, because marriages don't survive that long. You know?
And as we know, we've each had two.
Yeah, we got a lot
speaking
of them
from experience.
But we... I thought a moment, and I thought, you know, I think the reason is that never once do either one of us say, it's got to be my way, or this is my, it's got to be my idea.
Right.
I think as soon as you say, oh, it's got to be mine, there's no collaboration anymore.
Right.
I think if something is wrong, we sort of say, I don't know, it feels like it ought to be this. And then we listen. If David is convinced that his idea is good, he convinces me. If I convince him, we do something else. I've pretty much determined that if something doesn't feel right in the writing of it, either the words or the music, it's usually because we have misunderstood the scene.
Right.
And we go back and we rethink what's going on in the scene. Oh, the character's really doing this, and we said they were doing that.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
And so then you change it according to that. But it's never do it my way.
No, because that what you just described removes it from the personal. Because it's not about personal. It's about telling the story. It's about objective getting to
We once worked with an English director who had a wonderful locution. He said, I think the play wants to go here. I think the scene wants to go here, which is great because then it's nobody's fault.
Right.
It's nobody's opinion.
It's the play's fault.
Yeah. Just, the play wants to have a happy moment here.
Yeah. You know. The play's being a real pain in the ass here.
the play is not helping us here.
We also have enormous respect for each other's talents, and we all always have. Yeah. And so that leads to great trust. When Richard says something about a melody that I'm just crazy about, and he says, you can do better than that.
Right.
There's always a little twinge of, what does he know? but you know, that has passed long ago.
Yeah.
And he's probably right.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like a perfect marriage.
Well, right? it sounds like
in business and in life.
An egoless creative process.
Oh, exactly. I didn't say it was egoless.
Ego-light.
Ego-light, yeah.
Richard's passive-aggressive and I'm aggressive, so we kind of lock that way.
Passive-aggressive and I'm aggressive.
I have a question, though, to kind of bounce off of what Paul was asking you to, and the fact that you're in previews and what you were saying about Nielsen ratings and changing things. Are you still, you know, giving yourselves the liberty of making changes musically?
Or you mean like writing a new song? Or that
not
sort of
a
thing?
New song, necessarily.
It's
but
mostly, at this point, a clarification of the orchestrations. You know, is this part full enough? Is the ending strong enough? Can we hear the melody? Mm-hmm. Technical things, almost entirely.
So nothing to do with
changes,
the lyric? Or
we made changes a couple hours ago, right before we
came.
Oh,
you did?
Here. Wow. Took out some underscoring here, extended a button at the end of a number in another place. Joan Robbins once said, musicals are never finished. They're only abandoned. and it's kind of true. There's always seems like there's another detail that you can attend to. So they add up.
But I've also heard, and I don't know who said it, I wish I could pull it up here now, but also that art, the definition of an artist is the one who knows when to stop.
Yeah, sometimes you go a little too far.
Yeah.
What was it? Abe Burrows once came into a rehearsal of Guys and Dolls after it had been open a couple of months. He said, "We're going to have a rehearsal today to take out the improvements."
Woody Allen once said that he was reading that George Bernard Shaw he acquired the rights to My Fair Lady, and he was removing the music and lyrics, turning it back into Pygmalion. But you know, it's really funny because you're talking about being in previews and making tweaks as that's what previews are for existing work. So with something like this, that is basically a world premiere. Yeah. I imagine that the previews are just one of the most fertile creative times in the process, because it's the first time you have an audience to react.
They totally are, and part of the trick of it, the professionalism of it, is being able to release it. Shows, technically, it's all about control. You have to pull all the pieces together, and at the same time, creatively, you have to let it go. We had a scene that was set in one location, and the actors thought suddenly, well, wouldn't they actually be drinking something? And if they were, wouldn't they have a table? Well, they'd have a low table. Maybe they'd be sitting down. Well, if they're sitting down, maybe he'd have a different costume. And suddenly the scene was completely transformed into a different scene in a half an hour. And you have to trust that, and it's wonderful. I mean, the changes were absolutely great. It was okay before, but it was really brought alive. And that's just trusting that smart people are creative and trusting your brain.
And that never would have happened. That collaborative process couldn't possibly happen until this stage of the game, because you wouldn't have the other people there.
Actually, this show, any show, goes through multiple readings.
Sure.
Months apart. We must have had our first reading was in Bangkok. And then we had one 6 months later, and another one a year later. Then eventually we had a four-week workshop with two presentations. So it was like a staged production without sets and costumes, and just with the piano. And after each of those events, we do extensive rewriting. So really the preview period is the final extension of all of that.
Right, right.
But it is a learning process. You are, and the previews help you do this, you are learning what the show is. And you think you know, but the show is something else. It's made up of the things you think you know, but it's also something else. The actors and the way it's perceived by the audience. And it defines the story for you as you're going along. And the revisions usually come because you suddenly see a kind of clarity you didn't see before.
Right.
You don't just sort of rewrite things.
Right.
You rewrite things because something that was not clear is clear. Something that was not defined becomes expressed well.
I'm trying to figure out a way to say this without sounding like too earthy, crunchy, or highfalutin or anything, but
go there.
I think that what happens is that when there is so much creative energy going into one work, whether it's music, like you said, with the actors or with the director and all the people doing the collaborative aspect of it, that it does become, the play itself does become a living, breathing thing on its own. And that we made the joke earlier about the play wants to do this. Well, the play, if it does get some sort of a life to itself, then you are sort of informed by something that you didn't put on paper because of all that's coming
together.
We
had our last run through in New York, and I it was really good, and the actors were doing just such wonderful work. And I thought back to the first several days of rehearsal where they didn't know what they were doing. Many of them, and many of them seemed almost like amateurs, and they had become so professional and so strong over it. And I thought back, every now and then you should step one step away from it and think, you know what? When we went into rehearsal, there was no such thing as this show. And we all gathered together to create this. And when we finish this process, there will be a musical. There will be a new musical. And with any luck, it'll be a musical that'll speak to people. It'll go on for years. Maybe it'll be a classic. Who knows? But that's what we're doing. And what a privilege it is to be able to to participate in the creation of something. It's look, I made a hat where there never was a hat. You know, very much.
And, it's inspiring. It's inspiring. I want to, Michael. Do you want to share with people the information on how they can?
Excuse me. I'd be happy to.
And how?
Yes, indeed. The Waterfall, of course, the world premiere musical that we're speaking of. With the composers, is currently on stage in previews now through June 28th. It opens officially this Sunday, June 7th. And it plays Tuesdays through Friday evenings at 8 p.m., Saturdays at 4 p.m. and 8 p.m., Sundays at 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. Interesting thing to take note of. Talk Back Tuesdays are on June 9th, 16th, and 23rd, following the 8 p.m. performance, and a post-show discussion takes place June 21st, following a 2 p.m. performance. Prices range between $47 and on up. And the Pasadena Playhouse, of course, is located at 39 South El Molino Avenue in Pasadena. Online sales and information are very simple, pasadenaplayhouse.org, or call by telephone 626-356-7529.
And I've said it before, said it again. We talk about this all the time, being attending theater in Southern California. Pasadena Playhouse is one of those places. Get there early, park. There's all of these restaurants around there. You make a whole evening of it. There's actually that wonderful restaurant that's in that same little courtyard right
there.
Yes,
indeed. Yeah.
And they pour a good martini there.
Yes, they do.
I've had Red, White, and Blues.
Red, White, and Blue. There you go. I should know the name of it before I praise
which,
it.
Which, if I'm not mistaken, existed in another location in Pasadena, and then it, that whatever was in that space at the Playhouse, the restaurant, went on.
Yeah.
And this came in. So it was kind of nice
to have that move over there because
it had a following already, too.
Yeah, no, and it couldn't be more convenient to walk across the courtyard and you're there.
Yeah.
Let's do our arts calendar,
shall we, before we speak to
Mr. Shire here.
Yes.
After a six-year absence, writer Brooke Wyeth comes home to Palm Springs to tell her conservative parents about the upcoming release of her book, a personal memoir that reveals a long-buried family secret. Family politics are pitted against national politics in a clash that demonstrates how differences in perspective can be both devastating and necessary. Other Desert Cities was written by John Robin Bates, creator of TV's Brothers and Sisters and The Slap.
And the Broadway production received 5 Tony nominations and the Outer Critics Circle Award for Best Play. Full of sparkling wit, keen political observations, and richly drawn relationships, Rubicon Theater Company's production of Other Desert Cities stars Michelle Duffy, who's a dear friend of mine, Trey Ellett, Amanda McBroom, lovely singer that she is, Deborah Taylor, and Granville Van Dusen, and is playing now through June 21st at the Rubicon Theater in Ventura. For tickets, visit Rubicon Theater, that's spelled with an R-E at the end, by the way, rubicontheater.org.
I love the Rubicon.
Yeah, great theater.
Carrie Krim, who wrote Wake, did her production out
yes,
there.
Yes, I remember that.
Really enjoyed that space out there. And, of course, Tucker Smallwood, a great friend of the show, who did Sunset Limited out
That's
there
right.
with Joe Spano. Our next guest began scoring for television in the 60s and made the leap to scoring feature films in the early 1970s. He scored The Conversation, phenomenal motion picture, for director Francis Ford Coppola in 1974. Additional screen credits include All the President's Men, The Hindenburg, Farewell My Lovely, The Taking of Pelham 123, one of my favorite movies of all time.
I know.
The original Taking of Pelham 123, The Big Bus, Return, Short Circuit, Max Dugan Returns, and most recently Zodiac. You know, if only we knew some of these films. It's a shame. He composed original music for Saturday Night Fever, for which he received 2 Grammy Awards, and he won the Academy Award for Best Song for he and Norman Gimbel's theme song for Norma Rae. I knew there was a Norma in there somewhere. It Goes Like It Goes. As you've already heard, he is the co-creator of Waterfall, the epic musical now in previews at the Pasadena Playhouse. Please welcome David Shire.
Yeah. Oh,
hello, sir.
Yes.
He is here. He's taking his well-deserved bow.
Indeed.
So now, are you going to tell us that this whole creative process for you has been completely different than your partner?
No. It's as Richard said.
Right.
It's very close working together, and you know, people always ask which comes first, the music or the lyrics, and the answer in our case is the play, the scene, right, the characters. The score really is the extent, is the continuation of playwriting,
right,
by musical right. means.
How did you? What was your first acquaintance with this work? How were you made aware of it?
Well, it's interesting. Richard was approached by Tak Viveran, the Thai director and creator of the project originally. His story is fascinating. He built his own theater in Bangkok, where there was no tradition of doing American or American-like musicals, but he had been trained in communications at Boston University. And he came back to Thailand and went to a TV station and said, you know, I'm in communication. They said, oh, fine, start producing a series for us. Yeah. So the first thing he did was a Bangkok version of American Idol.
Okay.
And he started creating these wonderful stars, like, you know, Justin Bieber.
Sure.
Type stars. And then he built this theater and started creating musicals for them to star in.
Wow.
And it's a 2,000-seat, state-of-the-art theater. Richard calls it the most wonderful theatrical playpen.
He gets to do his own original musicals two a year. And they run for 6 weeks. That's the only audience. That's as much audience as they've got, and they pay off
because there are no unions. And he's got kind of a musical comedy sweatshop. Mm. He's got a basement full of designers and a room full of costumers.
It sounds like the beginning. It sounds Chaplin-esque. Yeah. It sounds like how it used to be for Chaplin, where he just sort of owned the factory and just generated, you know?
So one of the musicals he created was based on that novel, which became a movie, then which became the musical Behind the Painting. And he thought it was time to make a footprint in the United States, and teamed up with a producer, Jack Dalglish, who Richard had directed a musical for about 5 years ago.
Okay,
and the two of them came to Richard, who, having worked on Miss Saigon, was kind of the Asian Broadway connection.
I'm the fusion.
and said, "What do we have to do to make this Thai version?" Because it was all Thai cast and all Thai characters. What do we have to do to make it Broadway ready? And Richard looked at it and said, "Well, it's more than translation. You really need a whole new story and a whole new score." And so they said, "Well, who do you want to write the music?" And of course, I
scoured my brain to see if I could come up with anybody. And I don't know. I just thought of David. It just popped into my head.
One of those happy accidents, right?
The interesting thing is that it's not a period or a kind of music that we would have ever picked to write ourselves. But we thought, well, we're getting a nice advance, and we don't have anything to do for the next few months, so we'll do it like, you know, we used to do industrial shows. We professionalism, make it as good as we can, and do the work, and if something happens to it beyond that, fine. And within, 3-4 months, we were as passionately involved with this story and these characters and this musical as anything we've ever thought of on our own to write.
Everything that was odd about it suddenly became everything that was wonderful
about it. That
you
loved about it, sure.
Maybe because we weren't doing something conventional. We weren't doing something that references other shows, that we weren't doing a kind of score that other shows would have. And, you know, that's great.
It forces you to push
your envelope. Were you writing and working in Thailand when you were there?
No, we started here, and then, as I said, we went to Tak wanted to do the first reading in Bangkok, because the star of our show was the star of the show in Thailand, who is one of the big creations of Tak's Bangkok Idol.
Yes. He's a superstar there.
Yes.
He fills a 10,000-seat venue.
And he's 23, really? I think he told me?
Yeah. He was 23
his
once.
He's
more like 29 now.
Oh, 29.
His name is B-I-E, and I call him B-Burr.
But he's very charming.
He's the sweetest, most lovely, most undiva-like person I think I've ever worked with. And, of course, Thai young people revere old people. And Richard and I are, a little bit longer in the tooth than most of the people we work with now. And it's such a pleasure because he comes into rehearsal every morning. How are you, sir? What can I get you? Are you all right?
I haven't noticed that, but that's right. I guess maybe they treat you differently than me.
They treat you a little different.
So anyway, the show is built around him. Yeah. And so we did the first reading in Bangkok and had a wonderful week there, being shown around Bangkok by one of the great, great, great granddaughters of Chula Longkorn, the kid King and I, which was kind of interesting.
Yes.
Because the only musical that they can't do in Thailand is King and I, not because they don't like it, but because it has a scene in it which is purely sacrilegious to them, which is Shall We Dance, which is, of course, the biggest
number in the
scene
show.
In the music, because nobody touches the king. Would be like having an American musical with somebody jitterbugging with the Pope.
Right.
I keep mentioning that and thinking, that's a show I'd like to write.
Yeah, I was going to say, I sang with a band in college called Jitterbugging Pope.
Yeah, that's right. Did you have a chance to go to the palace at all?
The princess took us into some rooms that the tourists don't get to go to, and we found ourselves with our noses pressed against the floor.
Yes.
How long should we go, Your Majesty?
Exactly.
It was really thrilling, and we went to a Thai music school to see a lot of the instruments that we might be using, and we went to a Thai dancing school that talks. Two young daughters went to get a feeling for that because there's a big dance element in our show also.
It is an experience. I had the pleasure of going there with, I was representing Andy Gibb. Andy and any of his brothers, the Bee Gees, their music had never been performed live there at all. So his coming was at the invitation of the royal family and the princess, the daughter, who wanted to sing with him, and it was at a Christmas concert in benefit for one of her charities. And that was interesting. I mean, we were their guests for the whole time that we were there. We stayed in, they own several hotels there, and we stayed in one of them on the River of Kings, which was amazing. It went to the palace as well and had lunch with them and played in the air. Did you see the airplane? Is that still in the on the premises at the palace? It's the king's kind of toy. He gets in it and pretends he's flying. At any rate, the concert, going back to what you're saying about their ways and their customs, when Andy sang his first solo song, people waited to applaud because they all have to acknowledge the crown prince to see if they're what his reaction is. So they kind of follow him.
Huh.
When the princess and Andy sang together, which is what was her wish in bringing him over there, which was that Everly Brothers song, All I Want to Do Is Dream, or All I Have to Do Is Dream. And that was a big moment that closed the show, was that.
Sure.
So they sing the song. You're not allowed to apply. And this took about 3 or 4 minutes of the prince sitting there at his table and pondering if he was going to applaud or not applaud. And he did.
And he did.
He was smart, too, I suppose.
Okay. And
for
then
his sister's sake,
then,
at least.
Right. And then the roof came off.
And then everyone else goes. And for Andy, it was a very big deal. He didn't understand this at all, and he was a little miffed. But I said, hey, he got
astounding, though, how those cultural differences can be read as either rudeness or just without, just because we don't know and just because it's different,
Our second preview was for the Thai Association of Los Angeles.
Uh-huh.
Almost complete Thai audience, 600 people. And somebody said to us about an hour before the show, you know, Thai audiences don't applaud. And I thought, oh, my God, the actors, you know, who are nervous enough in the second preview, they're going to go out there and sing a big number and get total silence. Right. Luckily, they were Thai American.
Okay. Okay.
And they did applaud. But what was interesting, unlike American audiences, which give now a standing ovation to even shows they don't like to convince themselves that they liked it, they didn't react much during the show. But at the end, they cheered and they stood up.
Yeah.
But it was very interesting.
I found that with one. Well, I was doing a show in New York for a while, a one-person show that I did, and it was with the way it was marketed, we would get a lot of people of different Asian descents, and it was just like that. Very, very quiet. Very, you know, not as vocal as an American audience. And then at the end, they were, you know, outside the theater, they were so vocal about how much they enjoyed it, wanting autographs and things like that. It's just like, you know, why weren't you like that in there? You know? But that's another interesting point that you make, and I think this is why this is an important show as well as obviously a good show, but an important show. Because you mentioned King and I, you mentioned Miss Saigon. There are not a lot of musicals.
There are now.
Are there now?
King and I just happened to decide to be, you know, the play decides what it's going to do. It decided it was going to get revived.
Oh, did it?
This year, and took several of the cast people that we had in our workshop that we wanted to use in the show.
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure.
We were talking about this the other night, that there seemed to be more Asian theme musicals right now. I've heard of Richard. Aren't there a couple more coming in?
Well, there's a show called Allegiance that played out here.
That's been about the internment
of Japanese war, and that actually is finally coming to New York sometime during this year.
I saw it in a stage reading.
It's not. I mean, they're obviously it's very different from our show, but. I think there's another one somewhere in the works, but there is a definite need, I guess, for plays that along with everything else they do, speak to Asian audiences.
Sure,
there's a huge population out here, and the Pasadena Playhouse wants them to get used to coming. And so a lot of them are probably going to come to this show for the first time.
And I think there's a commitment that Pasadena Playhouse has made in that area of trying to find theater that will be appealing to
all. It was a very fortuitous win-win because they were looking for a show like ours and we were looking for a theater and an audience like theirs.
Exactly.
Isn't that, yes.
And you know, besides the Thai superstar B. Sukrit, you also have the wonderful, wonderful Emily Paget playing
great.
The female lead
from
Rock of Ages on Broadway, Paul, and also Sideshow, the 2014 revival of Sideshow.
She was one of the two Siamese twins.
Daisy Hilton.
She's doing a single.
Now she's separated.
What a glorious voice she has, right? Just effortless.
It's effortless, and it has a throb in it. It has a richness to it. Yes. It's not just pretty. It's got a heart. Every time I hear her just sort of sing a note, it always kind of is moving. And I think that's really
great. Funny you use that terminology of the throb in it. That's how I describe Bonnie Raitt. I think Bonnie Raitt is great.
Yeah.
You know, she's got the pipes, but at the same time, it's got such fluidity and
the extra quality in that usually makes the difference.
That's the intangible.
A nice singer and a great and a person you want to hear.
Yeah, you want them to tell you the story. We're talking about Waterfall at Pasadena Playhouse. This is, of course, at 39 South El Molina Avenue in beautiful downtown Pasadena. Online sales and information, PasadenaPlayhouse.org, or you can call 626-356-7529. It is in previews now, and you open in just a couple of days.
Yes? You open on Sunday.
You open Sunday at 3 o'clock. It's the opening matinee.
Yeah, it's a pre pre-Tony opening.
The pre-Tony opening. Be on stage through June 28th.
Yes, through June 28th. It's that time, Michael.
Yes, we have to baptize you now.
We have our...
Yes, did Paul tell you this?
Our last 5 minutes of the show where we ask our guests to share a sort of anecdote, a tale of woe, if any of those come readily to you.
Well, David reminded me of one when I went...
He's got the best one.
Just after we graduated from college, for some reason, we were like... picked up and sent out to California and on some kind of project. And somehow we managed to find ourselves in a car with the great writer Mark Connolly, who wrote Green Pastures. And he's a great raconteur and everything, charming. We're having this wonderful talk. And I decided to get kind of grand and mention that they had just done a television production of Green Pastures. And I said, it's just, you know, it's such a great play, but it's too bad that TV show was so terrible. Who on earth directed it? And Mark said, I did.
And his next word was, check, please. We were having dinner with him. You know.
Oh, priceless. Yeah.
Oh, that was funny.
And that was the time we auditioned.
But let me finish.
The time we auditioned a show for David Merrick. Oh. And at the beginning of the audition in his office, he put his head down between his legs, and he stayed there for the whole five numbers. We did. And then he... picked his head up and said thank you, and we thought it was a disaster, but apparently he did that with any time he was listening to something.
Really?
Oh. So you're singing to the top of his head and an immobile person and selling like crazy. You know, nothing registers because he's not looking at you.
Like Thai audiences.
Well, you know, or maybe maybe that's exactly it, to just remove himself from the process to not be pitched to.
I'm sure that was it. He just wanted to hear it. And,
what is the sound of no hands clapping?
You know, if I can add to that, I was once hired by David Copperfield to handle his public relations business on the road with his touring show. And he was playing here at the Pantages Theater. And the New York Management Company for his show asked me to come and meet him and have a meeting backstage. And I'm so happy to do it because I'm a fan. And the show was over, and it was just fun and amazing. And I went backstage and knocked on the door, and he said, come in. And he was in the fetal position on a couch. And that's how we had our meeting. He never spoke except to ask me a question. He never responded or, you know, never had anything else other than questions. I did, you know, provided the answers and never saw his face at all. And I don't know whether that was something, a physical thing that he did for himself to release tension or something after doing a performance. And he had an evening show to do as well. But it was so uncomfortable, and I was kind of, you know, weirded out, I guess, for lack of a better word. And I concluded all of the information that he was asking, you know, giving the information. And I said, well, is there anything else? And he said, no. He said, when can you start?
Really?
Yeah.
Just hired him.
And I represented him for 4 years.
That is very, very odd.
Yes, it was. I called the management company in New York. I said, really? You know, what?
Yeah, or you call him and find out and say that, does he have appendicitis? Or what, you know, is it?
He was a very nice man. I mean, we had a nice relationship for those 4 years, but a little distant, but it was a very nice relationship.
Well, speaking of nice men, gentlemen, this has been a pleasure having you on
indeed.
The show.
What a treat to be here.
We're so grateful to have you here, and we're delighted to tell the world about our little corner of the world about Waterfall. And this is at the Pasadena Playhouse once again. One more time, PasadenaPlayhouse.org for tickets, or 626-356-7529. And to our listeners who attend theater out here, I think Michael would agree with me, having seen it, that get your tickets now. Because when it is not in previews and it is reviewed and such, methinks that it's going to be more difficult to get one.
I think that you would be right.
Yeah. From your mouth to the critics' ears.
Gentlemen, a pleasure.
David, Richard, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Glad to have you on.
Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you. See you on the radio.
You're listening to State of the Arts with Michael Sterling and Paul Strohlig, right here on LA Talk Radio.